Welcome back to part two of Free Speech with CR. And our guests are Dr. George Batamianos, professor of history, and Dr. Peter Blakemore, emeritus professor of literature and environmental ethics. And we were talking about what role higher ed can play in the fight against the slide into authoritarianism, and what individuals can do and how important it is for individuals to do something. So take it away.
So what do you think individuals can do? Because I think some people feel hopeless.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to get that way because the government possesses the military, the power of violence. I mean, the government has almost a monopoly on it, you know.
So far, that's true.
Yeah, and so it's easy to get into that.
Well, and I think also our checks and balances feel like they're not holding as well.
Correct.
That's a very real fear that people have.
But that's a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that for me.
Well, that's a decision that our Congress, our House of Representatives and Senate have made.
Yeah.
So that's a decision that has been made. That doesn't have to be made.
No.
Right? And so as long as we have our Constitution the way it's written, I mean, you know, like I said before, you know, we see starting in the Second World War, the House of Representatives and the Senate have consistently yielded the power that is given to them in the Constitution over and giving it over to the executive. And that was a willful decision. And it was born out of necessity, in a sense, right?
Because of the war.
I mean, during the Second World War, there was a law.
And the Depression.
Yeah, in 1942, that where Congress just said, look, we're going to give our power of the purse and war. We're going to allow the declaration of war. We're going to vote for it. Then we're going to give authority to the president to conduct the war however he sees fit. And so, you know, FDR created the Pentagon and started the scientific research and development that led to the Manhattan Project and the bombs. And under Truman, that we have not had a declared war since. So Congress has basically said, we're just surrendering that authority that we have in the Constitution. And we're going to allow the president to make these military decisions.
And then individuals, you asked about individuals. Individuals need to see themselves as agents within a society. There are plenty of historical past periods and historical in the history where we can see where individuals did not see themselves as agents within a society. In the old feudal system, you didn't really own the land that you worked. You weren't really a slave. You were a vassal of a sort, but you were owned by the land because that was the only place you could live. And so the manor, the baron or whomever, the prince or whomever, basically owned the land that you worked. And I mean, we had something very similar to this with sharecropping.
Sharecroppers.
Yes. So, I mean, getting, you know, individuals seeing themselves as agents, which is, I think, one of the great things about teaching early American literature, which I used to teach a lot. You see the rise of individual agents, like Benjamin Franklin's one of my favorite things to teach because he saw himself as moving against social currents. You talk about Frederick Douglass, a great American. I mean, I often would tell my students, these are the two greatest autobiographies in America are going to be Benjamin Franklin and Frederick Douglass. You know, these are people who saw themselves having agency. And when people don't see that, when they see themselves as not having any kind of ability to make change in the world, to speak to one another out on the street, I mean, that kind of dampening that you see, which is something that we, I think, saw in Los Angeles when we started to see the movement of troops in, when people were starting to do basically fairly, I mean, I know that there was some violence in the streets and some fire bombing of cars and things like that. That's gonna happen sometimes. But, you know, if protests are largely nonviolent, then there's really no reason to stop them. And you and I will remember those from the 60s, the very large protest movement. So that means individuals saw themselves as part of, as having agency, as part of the pressure to bring to bear on the systems of government that were making decisions about, like, fighting wars, about whether Black Americans would have the vote, whether women would, you know, have better economic value in marketplaces, all those things. So, I mean, I think individuals need to see themselves as having agency. And I mentioned this in the earlier one. I'm a little bit concerned that Americans right now are letting their agency vanish into the ether through social media and other places where
it's like this craving of like somebody just lead us.
Yeah.
You know, and you could see that. I mean, you could see it with like all these superhero movies. You know what I mean? But that's really about it's just about this desire for somebody
to save you.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all, you know, they're the flawed superheroes, right? And so that's, you know, it's so parallel to this, what we have, you know, right now in the White House.
And so we've had people tap into that desire to be led.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
I think so.
For sure.
And you could see it in the 90s. I mean, I really do think that, you know, we talk about like how much conspiracy thinking has led us in this moment. And then we go to QAnon. But really, I mean, this has been part of American politics for forever.
Yeah.
I mean, Hofstadter wrote the paranoid style of American politics in the 1950s.
Yeah.
So, but we did see like in the 90s, there was this huge upswing in conspiratorial TV.
Yeah.
Right? X-Files was like the biggest show.
Right.
And so that thinking is proliferates when people don't feel like, they feel like, the forces around them are too strong and they can't make sense of it. And they don't feel powerful.
And there's the appearance of research
and
truth.
Right.
In internet. And now when we have deep fakes and the rest of this, it's like, well, what's true and what's not? And so we get a lot of that. I mean,
right.
I taught for and worked in higher ed for about more than 40 years. And this is something that I really noticed when George was talking about in the 90s, when students started telling me they didn't read newspapers at all. They didn't trust them. They were skeptical about everything. And I saw a much greater rise in this conspiracy mind, the mind that says, you know, somebody's doing something that's changing the world in ways that I want to find out. And then the internet, I think, really in the late 90s and early 2000s, really kind of that exploded. So you're learning how to think critically and to analyze information that you receive and to find out where it comes from and to do the tracing back through where it came from, and then doing the interpretation. These are things that take time. They take effort. The algorithm's not going to do it for you.
Hearing that from this conversation and what I've read is that people's trust in institutions is at an all-time low, which goes along with this idea of conspiracies and you can't trust anyone, you can't trust the media, you can't trust higher ed to give you the things that everybody's said.
And that's not just in the United States either. That's going on all around the world now. Tom Jute's great book. Yeah. Europe of the 20th century.
How do we combat that?
Well, higher ed is a place that teaches people how to do real research.
Mm-hmm.
And how to understand what they're looking at.
But if you don't trust the institutions.
Yeah.
I mean, that's about that. Now you're getting into the biggest problem here, which is honestly about kind of communal thought and whether people see themselves as connected to others within, mm-hmm. not just the individual. I mean, I've often talked to my students about it. I said, what's the ideology that drives America in the United States? It's individualism for sure. There's no doubt. All you have to do is read the Constitution, read the Declaration of Independence, read Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, read early American lit. It's individualism. And this is why so many people flock to the United States, to the colonies, is because
American dream.
Yeah, and it gave them the opportunity. If you read the Captain John Smith fake Pocahontas story. His main reason for coming he was trying to sell people on the colonies on North America, and it was because you could hunt whenever you wanted, you could fish whenever you wanted, it wasn't owned by a lord. So individualism is highly a super important aspect of American culture and ideology, but communalism is also super important.
Yep.
So if you look at these towns on the prairie in Nebraska in the 1870s, you read a great novel like Willa Cather's My Antonia, where she shows how these people came together and they would perish if they did not come together. So, you know, that whole concept of individual plus communal and that balance.
It's like,
and right now we're kind of not, we've kind of lost.
Well, and when you lose faith in the institutions, then you find the tribes, right? So that's this kind of splintering into the tribalism,
right?
More than the company.
Yeah, yeah, that's the us versus them,
right?
Paradigm that there's a somebody to hate as opposed to there's a reason to kind of work together to get somewhere,
right?
Which, you know, eyes on the prize, as the famous comment from the civil rights was always like, keep your eyes on the prize. So, I would be interested to know what George thought about this, about whether he sees a rise in literacy, a decline in literacy. I mean, he and I both actually worked on the Humboldt Literacy Project for many years. We were board members. So, you know, we kind of recognize how important being literate is and being able to read. You know, history is really about, it's not archaeology. So it's, you know, you are looking at material culture, but you're really looking at documents, really. You need to see what people said, what they believed, what they thought, how they interacted.
I mean, history is about using human writing as the basis.
Yeah.
Prehistoric just means prior to writing.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I only know anecdotally. And so I know that, like the people I know who teach English literature are telling me that students don't read books anymore. And they, you know, I mean, I'm in a different environment. Because in the prison,
you're teaching at Pelican Bay State Penitentiary,
a
College of the Redwoods courses at Pelican Bay.
Right. And the guys there are reading. I mean, so, but I understand from my colleagues that's becoming harder and harder. And so it's going to have to shift. I mean, I think there's going to have to be a lot more reading in class.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, and it's tough. I mean,
reading in class versus homework.
Yeah.
Yeah. Telling people, you have half an hour to read this essay.
Yeah. And then write about it
because they won't read it if you don't.
One won't read outside of class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it could be important. I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad thing or a good thing. It could be the way that things need to move. There was that interesting piece about AI. And I've been reading some stuff about a lot of institutions now have gone back to like blue book test.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And doing things in class. Let's read this and take it apart. I mean, I do a lot of that in my teaching as well. And we used to do it all the time.
Yeah.
Where it's like, hey, okay, we're gonna take a look at this piece now. And
or you're gonna present ideas in the classroom to the rest of your colleagues.
Yeah. And it's very valuable that way. Mm-hmm. So higher ed is good for that too. It's also good for promoting a sense of community. This is why I think the pandemic obviously just exacerbated all this, you know, with the isolation, but also like, I think I don't read the history of higher ed. There's a lot of great scholars who do this work. But it seems like the turn to DE and thinking that was going to be the thing that just ends up creating an atomized classroom. And now this move toward, you know, well, you know, the student X has, you know, from 3 to 4 on Tuesdays when they can do this work. And then student Y is like, but we want them all in the same class, but they're not really in the same class. And so basically now you're just furthering the atomization. You're not really creating a class or experience that students are going to have together. And there's so much more that happens in a classroom between students than just learning English or learning math. There's a lot of interaction that goes on between them.
And that's the model for the communal setting. I mean, I taught environmental ethics here for, I don't know, 15 years or something. And I mean, obviously you can't think of I used to tell them beginning of the semester, you couldn't think of a better place to teach that than right here, where you have timber families, fishing families, you know, hippies, everybody's here, the environmental activists.
In the room.
In the room.
Yeah.
And we would be able to, and I know you've visited my class more than once. We would have these large discussions. 40 students would be talking to one another about what's going on. Now that's about agency.
Yeah.
And it's about real learning, where I would always tell them, I've learned as much as you have in this semester because of all the ideas that you brought into the room.
use
getting out of the silos that you find when
exactly right, and finding out what other people actually think.
Yep.
So
you know, I've been thinking about this MAGA movement, and I've been trying to understand it for the last 8 months. Something that you both just said crystallized why it's so prevalent in America. It's because of change. People fought change.
Oh yeah,
they want to go back. And what you just said is, some parts of higher ed doesn't want to change as well. They want to go back to the old ways. So I'm wondering.
There's definitely like a sense of nostalgia.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's definitely a sense of nostalgia with it. But it's probably for a back time that doesn't exist, only exists in a people's mind.
So are you saying that what you're now espousing doesn't really exist in it?
It's not a nostalgia, what we're talking about. I mean, what I would say, here's how I think that's a great, I think your question is an excellent question, because you just made me stop and think, okay, maybe I have been being nostalgic. But what I really think about is that now there's this narrative of the inevitability of artificial intelligence,
right,
and that it's going to be used, it has to be used in our classrooms, and we have to use it. And, you know, there's just a little bit of that I agree with, which is like, it's not going to go away, but do we want to put curbs on it? Do we want to figure out how it can be best used? And what I am concerned about, especially with artificial intelligence right now, is that this inevitability of it, this claim that this is just going to roll right through, so figure out how to get on board, that we're never going to examine how it doesn't work. And I can tell you a bunch of ways. I mean, I wasn't teaching for the last few years. I was a dean here, but I talked to the faculty all the time about how AI had been influencing what they were able to do in the class. And usually it wasn't doing it in a good way. So I only found that the people who really could work with it were the ones who tried to get ahead of it and figure out how to manage it in such a way that it wasn't affecting the things they wanted from their students. So think about that. Right now, it seems like the super powerful multi-billionaires are running the show.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are going to make the decisions about what is going to happen in all of our lives.
Yeah.
That doesn't talk about agency. Then Americans feel like, and that's the same thing that people who lost their manufacturing job in Michigan or Ohio, in their steel mills in Pennsylvania in the 1990s, in the 80s and 90s. That's what they felt, the loss of agency.
Deindustrialization.
Yep. The deindustrialization, yep.
And when you use that inevitability idea, it makes people feel like it's a foregone conclusion, and so there's no reason to do anything.
Yeah. Why should I?
Yeah. There's nothing to be done.
There's no and that's exactly what they want. They don't want regulation. They want free reign over what happens with AI in the future.
Yeah. George said something in the first segment, and something that I used to always say. Well, we used to say it in our class because we team taught. I think we said in the first for at least a dozen years. We were in the classroom together for like 12 years in with the students. And what we would tell them is, and I'd say it to my own classes, you know, why do we call it the liberal arts? And the reason why we call what we're doing in history and literature in these fields of study, critical thinking, philosophy, why do we call it the liberal arts? Because it's supposed to liberate us. It means what the idea, the concept was, is that you would know enough that you wouldn't need to have somebody else do things for you. You could make the choice about what was the right way for you to manage your life. You could make the choice about where you wanted to live. You could make the choice about which crops you wanted to plant. You could make the choice about, you know, whether to grant women the right to vote. I mean, that you were liberated in that way. And this has been the kind of moving emphasis behind all the freedom movements in America. And, you know, libertarians these days have gone a little far to the, I don't know which direction to put them in, but that's kind of was the motivating force behind a lot of the concepts of libertarianism.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's really odd today to see libertarians accept the
authoritarian.
Yes. That is basically creating limits to their freedom.
Yeah.
That's very bizarre to me.
Yeah.
Well, is there such thing as too much freedom?
Yeah, and another good
talk to Hop.
Great question.
Another great question. Yeah. Nature is nasty, brutish, and short.
Is there a limit to it that we should have freedom? And freedom to do what? Are there limits to what?
Freedom to murder each other?
But it still happens.
It does, yeah. But we're not free to.
It's not.
I mean,
it's
you
not,
can't be. Yeah. Well, you can have your freedom removed for doing it.
That's not totally true. I could see that. However, in the run up to this election,
mm-hmm.
now what was espoused is this person can kill someone on the street and he'll still be elected president, and that was accepted.
I mean,
except
he's got a point.
So I really am curious.
Yeah,
is there a limit to what we accept as free?
Well, the limits are the extent of your arm to somebody else's face and their ability to have the freedom to do what they want. And that's kind, I mean, this is an interesting philosophical mm-hmm. point. I mean, anarchists would right. claim that you shouldn't have any controls placed upon you, because if you're a good person, you will not harm another person.
Right.
But what we know from social organization over the last, especially the last 500 or 600 years, is that it doesn't usually work out that way.
No.
Somebody wants more than the other person, and there's some bad actors who aren't going to honor the other person's right to not be molested or harmed. And we may be seeing plenty of that right now. People who don't have empathy, they don't really feel that another person's pain or suffering is something that affects them in any way, if they can get what they need for their family, for their tribe.
Mass deportations.
Yep, mass deportations.
Which is accepted in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's another huge...
And it hasn't before, too. This is not...
No, it happened under Eisenhower. Obama deported 400,000 people.
Did.
So, I mean, that was pretty mass.
You know, during the beginning of the War on Terror, we had those black sites where we were banning people. And so, I mean... Yeah, you know, habeas corpus, stopping habeas corpus is a very serious, I mean, it's what, Lincoln did it during the Civil War. I think, did FDR do it at all? No, he never did have to.
Well, he did, except it was the Japanese internment.
Yeah, certainly. That was,
these are all presumed
laws of habeas
to be spot.
And habeas corpus just means you have to present the body, basically. You have to be brought in front of a magistrate and told what the charges are.
Why are you being held, right?
Yeah, and if you're not told why you're being held, how long can you be held? Well, that's
the only time.
Forever, apparently. Okay. You can be disappeared. And if we start living in a society where people are okay with others being disappeared, then we are really in trouble.
Well, this comes back to the checks and balances of the rules and norms that seem to have been thrown out the window under this administration. It's leading to this idea that some people are free to do whatever they want and others aren't. So
the thing to really watch for, I think, right now is, I'm not seeing very much of it. I'm seeing it from lower federal courts, but I'm not seeing it from the Supreme Court, but whether they ever make the challenge of you must stop. Because what they've been doing mostly is holding up a green light.
To the more powerful executive.
Yes. Keep going.
That's true.
Keep going. Keep going. And that, I mean, this was what happened to Nixon, by the way. Georgia mentioned him, is that all of the Supreme Court found that he would have to release the tapes.
Yes.
The Nixon tapes. And as soon as those came out, we had Republican senators coming to his office telling him, you got to resign.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't happen today.
No.
Well,
no shame.
That was the court that required that he release the tapes. And even though his secretary had probably told her to erase a bunch of they erased a bunch of it, but still, it was damning. He was definitely doing things that were violation of the law, constitutional violations. And that's when Nixon said, when the president does it, it's not illegal.
Right.
And this president has what, 40 felonies?
I thought it was only 34.
Right.
That's more than 30. Okay.
It's more than I have.
Yes, more than I have.
Now, here's the other thing that I've struggled with is the fact that in the classroom, we say that higher ed is the answer. But we also have seen where if there are students or parents or most students in the classroom that don't really like what a professor is saying, then they can inform on them, right? And so what then can we do?
This is very, that's, this is.
Because, of course. So we.
Yeah, we had that.
So we are back McCarthy in America grading.
Right. Yeah. It just.
It's that same period of time.
Right. It just reminds me of On the Waterfront,
Which
was the idea that ratting's okay. you know? So it's like, hey, good, you know?
If you're fighting communism, then it's okay.
Or if you're fighting the mob union.
Yeah, the mob union, basically.
So stand up for that. What would you say to your faculty colleagues? When fear is pervasive in the classroom, what do you tell them? Because I'll tell you what I have said to them, but I'm curious to see.
I would hope that, I don't worry about that in the case of CR, but because I know it well. I've been here 25 years, right? I would hope that at any institution, that really where this falls down is if the administration doesn't have the backs of the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And it falls down in a number of ways. I mean, if we can look at what happened at Evergreen in the early or to mid 2000s,
yeah,
and the administration there did not have the backs of certain faculty members.
I remember it very clearly.
Right, because
actually I was close to it. Yeah.
Yeah, and so here, you know, it's like, okay, you know, if we're going to teach the honesty about slavery, you know, I'm not going to teach it as a job improvement system or anything, you know, some stupid
which we've heard.
I know.
Oh, no, that's we've fine
heard. And then somebody and we're reading, you know, we're reading Echiano, we're reading, you know, we're reading these slave narratives, or we're reading the perspective of slave owners, you know, and we're reading that in the classroom, and we're using that to sort of talk about, like, what were these systems like? And then a student says, well, you know, they're not teaching that this was a positive thing, and they go rat up the chain, you know. I would hope that, you know, my administration would be like, okay, you know, look, this, you don't have a basis for a complaint here.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you're seeing, I feel like, you know, I was an administrator here and had to, and so was he.
You were,
we were both 5 years, and we recognized the need for academic freedom and for the ability of an instructor to speak what they saw as the truth or what they could verify through documentary, through insight into documents. And so, and I always have felt like you had my back, and people above me had understood that we have to maintain this if we're going to have free interchange of ideas and build that communal sense of agency. And so, you know, but let's be honest, there are lots of institutions right now that are caving. And I think what George said, and you, I think, know this, Keith, it really has been the administrators who haven't backed up faculty who want to maintain. And it's not, and this way, it's both directions, right and left. You have to give people the freedom to investigate ideas. Yes.
Which George, you said, is like, what's important is that we don't cave like other schools have caved. And we have been on record to say we will not do so. So,
yeah.
And we'll be having another conversation.
Really important
about academic freedom
later on, and freedom of speech.
Right.
Semester.
Anyway, so thank you very, very much for being our first guest of our CR, Free Speech at CR podcast.
I hope we kicked it off well.
I hope we seem to speak freely.
Right.
You did, and there's lots more questions that we have answers for, but you have stimulated our minds on our future questions.
Thank you.